Future Proof Gold from News Talk.
Now, with no gravity or atmosphere to speak of, and temperatures lurching from minus 127 to minus 173 centigrade, the moon is a dangerous place. But that being said, certain death, if exposed to its environment, isn't stopping us from trying to get there. Far from it. But there is one tiny thing that might put a spanner in the works if we ever want to set up on the moon, and it's not the lack of oxygen or radiation. Dr. Philip Metzger is a planetary scientist at the Florida Space Institute from the University of Central Florida. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Philip.
Hello, glad to be here.
When people think about what the biggest challenge to landing on the moon, working on the moon, setting up bases and having things work that we could possibly explore further, dust is not something that people would first think of, I would imagine.
No, but it was. It became really apparent during the Apollo program that it's a major issue. In fact, some of the astronauts, including Jack Schmidt, who walked on the moon, have said that it is the largest problem to exploring the moon.
Why dust? Tell me about the surface of the moon and what it's made of and what we know about it.
Yeah, so the environment of the moon makes it very different than the Earth. Here on the Earth, we have an atmosphere that maintains liquid water at the surface. So we have rain, and that rain washes the dust out of the environment. It cleans out the sand, it cleans out the soil, and then the dust runs down the rivers into the ocean and to shallow seas where it settles to the bottom as mud, and then it eventually turns into mudstone. So there's a geological process to constantly take dust out of the environment. But on the moon, that doesn't exist. Instead, because of the lack of an atmosphere, there is constant infall of micrometeoroids busting apart the rock and creating more and more dust. So some places on the moon, the dust might be as much as 20 or 40% of the bulk of the soil. If you grab a handful of soil, the dust is all mixed in throughout it, and it's just pervasive.
In terms of, I mean, I know nothing about the size of a typical dust particle, but the size of moon dust is an issue.
Yeah, so the dust particles here on the Earth are, they're typically 1 to 10 microns, but they're not that abundant. And your body is really good at filtering them out of your lungs. So when you breathe in, the mineral dusts that are smaller than 10 microns are so rare. And they just get caught in the mucus, in the inner workings of your breathing system, and your body takes them back out. But on the moon, we've got lots and lots of dust between 1 and 10 microns, which is able to follow the airflow so precisely that it gets through all the defenses of your body. It gets down into the very bottom of your lungs, and it'll be there for the rest of your life because your body has no way of getting it out. And so that can cause long-term health problems.
Did we see this in any of the astronauts that came back from the moon?
There were some temporary effects. They had some wheezing. They described it as symptoms similar to hay fever. But fortunately, we've never had anybody exposed to it so much that it built up to being a lifelong condition. However, in the laboratories where we work, we're very worried about it. We take extreme precautions to make sure that we don't breathe the simulated lunar dust that we're working with.
Simulated lunar dust? You created fake lunar dust?
Yeah, it's actually a little bit of an industry. There are a lot of groups around the world trying to create the best fake lunar dust. And
really?
It's really hard. Yeah, it's true. I was part of a team that was from the European Space Agency as well, developing their own European lunar simulants. And I'm a part of a group here at the University of Central Florida that has our own little industry of creating simulated lunar dust. We call it the Exolith Laboratory. But the geology is so exotic on the moon, it's really difficult to create that in a laboratory. And you can tell when you look at the fake lunar dust, you can say, oh, that's not very good fake lunar dust, because it takes hundreds of thousands of dollars to make really good fake lunar dust.
What? What is so special about lunar dust? And why is it not just rock shavings or what is it?
Well, because on the moon, with the lack of an atmosphere, there's interplanetary dust constantly bombarding the surface of the moon. And when it hits the surface, it's coming in at thousands of meters per second. And that causes vaporization and melting of the material. And then that molten material splatters and it glues together, it cements together lots of other little rock particles inside of a matrix of glass. but also because the moon is constantly showered with hydrogen from the sun, the chemistry is a very, we call it chemically reducing. And so whenever you get any of this molten stuff, the hydrogen wants to combine with the oxygen and it takes the oxygen away, and that creates little bits of free metal. So inside this glass, there are tiny little specks of metal which are magnetic. And trying to replicate, we call this nanophase iron, but trying to replicate that in a laboratory is very expensive. And also, the vaporization that occurs causes vapor deposition on top of the surfaces of all the dust grains. And so there's a little glass coating on top of every dust grain that gives it unique electrostatic properties.
Okay, and that leads us to the second problem beyond human health. This dust is persistent, and when you can't get to the moon without machines, and this dust is a problem.
That's right. It gets into the crevices of your machinery. It gets into the mechanism and jams them up. It causes abrasion and wears things out. Things will break, and it will coat your solar cells. It will coat your radiators so that you can't get rid of heat from your machinery. It's just a persistent problem everywhere you look.
It kind of I've been to Burning Man 3 times, and it kind of reminds me of the dust there, which gets everywhere and is very difficult to get rid of. But of course, in space on a lunar mission, it's not like you can clean it away to somewhere, right? It's not like you can clean away a surface and work in that surface because it's everywhere on the surface.
Well, we do want to keep it out of the insides of our spacecraft. So we're trying to develop methods to avoid tracking it in so that we will have clean spaces. In the Apollo programs, when they came inside with their spacesuits and then took the spacesuits off and they filled it with air and then took their spacesuits off, then the dust came off the spacesuits into the air, and so they were breathing it. We don't want that to happen in the future. So we want to create technologies to keep the dust out. And we don't think that there's any one technology that can do it. We have to put on a series of battle lines to stop it, prevent it, reduce it every step along the way.
Presumably, a Hoover isn't going to be very effective. You because of this electrostatic property, there's forces you have to combat as well.
That's right. The van der Waals force and electrostatic forces cause the dust to cling onto surfaces. It can get into the fabric, into the weave of fabrics, and then it wants to cling to those surfaces. And so we're looking at a variety of physical processes to remove it, not only using airflow like a Hoover, but we're also looking at using ion, blowing an ion stream onto the dust in order to electrically neutralize it. We're looking at using magnetic fields. As I mentioned, there's this nanophase iron embedded in the glass coatings on the dust. So the dust is highly magnetic. And so we can use that. We can also use electrostatic techniques. We can charge the surfaces and then rapidly change the voltage on the surfaces to drive the dust off. So some people have been developing these electrodynamic dust screens that will cause the dust to walk along the surface and then fall off the edge. And that's pretty cool. It happens so quickly. It just looks, you turn the switch and the dust just vanishes immediately.
Wow.
And then NASA recently gave some selected some semifinalists in a competition. I was one of the judges of the competition, looking at a variety of ways to uniquely remove dust from the surface of different objects. Like one group was looking at creating animal fur on the outside of spacesuits, because there are certain animal species that somehow don't get dirty. They were looking at how does the fur as a system function to mechanically and electrodynamically keep dust out of the fur. And so we're looking at biology for biologically inspired solutions.
I mean, I've been doing this program for 11 years. This is such news to me that that is such a big problem and that there are so many people working on different solutions for it. What was their first inkling that this was an issue? Can you tell me a little bit about the dust detection experiments during the Apollo years?
Yeah, so Brian O'Brien was the principal investigator. He was from Australia. He just passed away this past year. But Brian was a never-ending, never-tiring advocate of studying the dust problem. So he built this little tiny experiment. It was just three solar cells, But the more dust they got on them, then the less sunlight they would collect. And so it became a measure of the dust. And he designed this experiment to go on the Apollo Lunar Surface Experiment package, the ALSEP, which was it was left on the moon. So when the astronauts came back to Earth, it was still there operating for a number of lunar days. A lunar day is 29 and a half Earth days. So anyways, it was collecting data. The sun was rising and falling, and every time the sun came up and down, you could look at the power level going up or down. And he many, many years later, back in the mid around 2010, 2009, when he was retiring from the University of Australia, Western Australia at Perth, he rediscovered these data tapes in a cardboard box under a table. And so he resurrected his study of the dust detector experiment, which generated a lot of excitement inside NASA in the United States. Everybody was like, who is this guy? And is this for real? Did he really rediscover these ancient tapes that we thought were lost? And so we had meetings inside NASA talking about it. But yeah, Brian, before his death, he worked year by year for about a decade analyzing those data tapes and made a lot of progress understanding the behavior of the dust every day as the sun would come up and then set again on the moon.
And from that, did we get an understanding of how solar technology might be impacted by this? Because, of course, there's the mechanical problems that can happen when dust jams in joints, for example. But also, there's potentially a loss of power to solar cells if this dust sticks on the panels and won't remove and restricts the energy.
Yes, that was precisely what he was seeing. What he noticed was that from the very start of the experiment, the power levels were lower than expected. And what he concluded was that the astronauts just walking around on the moon was kicking up enough dust that some of it went up to chest level and landed on this experiment. He called that collateral dust. So the discovery of the significance of collateral dust was pretty important. But then what he discovered was that when the Apollo lunar modules left, some of the collateral dust blew off. And so it cleaned the dust experiments, but it didn't clean them completely. But then the next lunar morning, when the sun came up, they got even cleaner. It turns out that the sunlight is a cleaning effect. The bright ultraviolet light charges the dust and it causes the dust to repel itself off the surface. That's good news that there is a self-cleaning effect on the moon. However, he also argued that every morning when the sun came up, there was a dust storm because as the sun came above the horizon, the experiments were not seeing as much sunlight as they should have seen until the sun got a few degrees above the horizon. So he argued there's about a 1 meter high dust storm every morning as the terminator line, the line marking between day and night on the moon, as that line passes over your location.
And he just figured that out from the data. Was he proved to be right?
Well, it's still very controversial.
Right.
He published this paper a couple of years ago, and so there was some interest in his theories, but we really have to get back to the moon and get more data before we can settle this. The whole idea that there's natural dust transport on the moon is rather controversial. Some people have argued, no, there's no evidence of any significant dust transport. The dust falls, and wherever it falls, that's where it stays. But others are saying, no, we know it's moving. First of all, impacts on the moon are constantly knocking it around. But also, these electromagnetic effects from the sunlight causing it to move around. So there's a number of people studying it in different ways. They're looking from orbit. Can we see the dust moving around on the moon? They're looking at it from these old dust detector experiment data files. And we're also proposing new experiments to go to the moon to take some of these measurements.
Your main area of research isn't specifically this at all, is it, Phil? You look at how soil is affected by landings of spacecraft. I'm wondering, it seems like such a niche area, but I've been to European Space Agency. I've seen these really, really specific and niche problems that a single researcher or a team can be assigned to. Tell me a little bit about your research and why it's so important to think about the soil around a landing site?
So I was part of the team in NASA that was working on space resources. One of the easiest aspects of space resources that we say it's easy, but it's we think it's the low-hanging fruit. This will be the first thing that we do with resources in space, which is making rocket fuel. So you want to have your rocket land at a gas station and fuel up and then fly away on Mars or on the moon. But to do that, you have to land right next to your gas station. Some of the managers at NASA said, we need somebody to take a look at what does the rocket exhaust do. Does it blow rocks into our gas station? Is it going to sandblast the gas station and ruin it? So they asked me to take a look at that. That was about 23 years ago. And at the time, I think I was the only person in the world studying this problem. And I realized pretty quickly, it's actually a very big problem. It's much bigger than we had realized before. All throughout the 2000s, I was arguing with NASA, trying to prove my point that we need to plan to solve this problem. We need to plan to build landing pads on the moon or on Mars. And we can't just ignore it. There was a lot of reaction against this because building a landing pad on the moon or Mars takes extra missions. And nobody wanted to add extra missions into the timeline because we're talking about billions of dollars to do this. And this is going to delay the entire program by years. So there's a lot of resistance to accepting the fact that we have to do it. But finally, by the end of the Constellation program, around 2010, 2011, the agency had finally started to admit we need to build landing pads on the moon. So now there's a large community growing around the world tackling the problem. We have a lot of people doing computer modeling, trying to understand how rocket exhaust blows in vacuum. So when you get supersonic rocket exhaust expanding into vacuum, it's totally unlike the flows of gas eroding soil here on the Earth. We don't understand the turbulence. We don't understand the boundary layer flow. We don't understand what scales the erosion rate. And we also don't understand the bulk effects. When does the rocket dig a crater versus when does it just scour the surface like during the Apollo landings? So there's a lot of physics that we still have to solve. And so there's a large teams now working on it, trying to get ready for returning to the moon.
This is why they say it's not exactly rocket science. They're not just talking about how much fuel to burn. They're talking about all of these tiny calibrations, experiments, simulations that go together to have a successful mission. Really, really fascinating speaking with you. I never thought I could listen to someone talk about dust for so long. But Dr. Philip Metzger, planetary scientist from the University of Central Florida, brilliant speaking with you. Thanks for your time.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.